We take a single episode of a science fiction TV series and overanalyze it to within an inch of its life. This is the Fusion Patrol Podcast. Welcome to the discussion.
Hello and welcome to a special cold and flu season episode of Fusion Patrol. I'm Eugene.
And I'm Simon.
And one of us has a cold or flu. I'll let you decide, dear listener. Tonight we are looking at the Doctor Who Christmas special, The Return of Dr. Mysterio. So just out of curiosity, before I get started with the brief recap, Simon, how many Doctor Who Christmas specials have we done?
Have you and I done,
or yes.
Have
we? Yes.
Have you and I done? I don't know. I can't answer that.
We did River Song, right? Husbands of River Song.
Did we do River Song? I didn't think we did River Song. Maybe I blotted it out of my memory. We definitely did the one with all the layers of memories of the Inception.
Oh, yes.
One. I've forgotten what that was.
Right. And I think we did The Lion, the Witch, and the Wardrobe.
Quite possibly.
And maybe A Christmas Carol. I think that's it. Well, and we've also done Christmas Invasion, because it was part of the Regeneration.
Yes, special, post-talk.
So we've got a history of these. So just keep that in mind when we go. It's a man's room in New York City, and he's having a dream about when he was a child, and he met Santa Claus. Well, not really Santa Claus, more Dr. Mysterio, a strange old man trying to build a Christmas tree on the roof, who gives him superpowers. Then in the future, or the present, aliens are invading Earth through the company Harmony Shoal, the same aliens we saw previously in The Husbands of River Song. They have a plan to destroy New York, cause all of the world capital leaders to go to the Harmony Shoal buildings, and have their brains taken over by independent brain-like organisms. Meanwhile, the little boy, Grant, has grown up into the Ghost, a superhero who is also saving New York City in the Doctor's 24-year absence. He is a nanny in his secret identity for the reporter who is also investigating Harmony Shoal. Hilarity ensues as he keeps his secret identity away from the woman he loves. I'm not going to go any further into the plot on this one. It's And I mentioned the Doctor and the Ghost save the day there at the end. So I'm just curious, just right off the bat, what did you think?
Oh, I loved this one. It's a particular pleasure when Doctor Who do the kind of genre thing. Although actually this steers quite dangerously close to ripping off a particular film, which can be good, but it's a risky strategy, because either you spend your time thinking of the film, if it's a film you like, and comparing it and unfavorably, or you know worst case scenario, it starts to it sort of starts to undermine the nice feeling you have about the film. But actually, I thought this was a kind of pitch perfect tribute to Superman, and the writing and the casting and all of the performances and the kind of nice sort of light it's a holiday film. It's a holiday film. And it needs to be considered as such. It's not Moffat and Capaldi doing the kind of full on drama of Heaven Sent or whatever. But it is both of them, I think, at the absolute top of their game. In fact, if I had to pick my favourite Capaldi performance so far, this is it.
Interesting. Okay. Well, I mean, I enjoyed it. And I'm not particularly inclined to enjoy the Christmas specials, just simply because they're kind of often lame. And, you know, the Doctor, the Wardrobe, and the whatever it was, the Blue Box, or I cannot remember the name of that one in particular, was kind of dire. And I know you and I disagree on the flying sharks one, but I enjoyed this one. I mean,
because it was wonderful. And that's the thing. They alternate. I think you get a duff one, and you get a good one.
That's right. You didn't like the Husbands of River Song. I don't remember what I thought of the Husbands of River Song. I didn't love it. I remember that. I don't remember if I hated it, but I didn't love it. But I really enjoyed this one, and you're right. I mean, this is clearly an homage to, you know, they say it's an homage to comic book superheroes, but really it is the Richard Donner, Christopher Reeve Superman
yes.
film of the 1970s, right down to the actor they got playing the part. And then, as you say, there's some dangerous points here where they have the scene on the rooftop where they're doing the interview. And as I was watching it, I was kind of thinking, that's a little close.
Can you read my mind?
Yeah. Yeah. That was a little close to a scene right out of that film. And, you know, superheroes have such a broad, group of cliches that you can draw on that I don't know that they needed to actually set it on the roof and go through the dinner.
Oh, no.
To talk about, you know, but it worked. It generally worked. So
I think you're right. I don't think they were going for the kind of broad set of superhero cliches. They were doing Superman, which is fine in that they did it really, really well. I mean, it could have gone horribly wrong, but I liked the fact that they, I mean, so it was Superman. The ghost had Superman's powers, basically.
Pretty much, yeah.
He wasn't from another planet, but the superpowers were from another planet. So that's kind of near enough. He's secretly in love with a reporter. Yada yada yada. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mild mannered. It's got all of the things of Superman, and I'm no superhero aficionado really, and so I can't sort of pick out from the pantheon of possible superhero powers and tropes that they could have used, but that. In that sense, it's a film for me because Superman sticks out as a film I really like in a genre that actually doesn't really do that much for me. So, you know, most of the, I mean, I haven't read the comics. I don't know anything about Superman from the comics. I don't read superhero comics. And there seemed to have been just a swathe of superhero stuff, particularly in recent years. Mm-hmm. And it's all kind of passed me by because, you know, I've dipped in here and there. And for the most part, I'll make a few exceptions. I saw Kick-Ass and Pixar's Incredibles was pretty good. And a mention for Jessica Jones, which I thought was very good. But again, you know, I haven't seen the comics. So in a way, it kind of means nothing to me. And I know that for a lot of people, they're stepping into a world that is more than just, you know, it's a set of overlapping, it's a universe that all of this stuff exists in. But you could go down the rabbit hole with that, because I think most of the audience is probably more on the casual end of this stuff. Because it's, you know, it's going out on BBC One on Christmas Day. It's not a cinema release to attract the kind of hardcore comic nerds.
The 1970s, the Christopher Reeve Supermans were a love letter to the comic books. I think that's the way we usually look at it. They were not in any way updated for a cynical modern audience. And I think that's what really works nicely with the earlier Superman film. It has failed miserably, in my opinion, in later films. And the DC films, Batman, Superman, of the last few years have been so dark and so updated for modern sensibilities that are not what 8-year-olds are reading comic books about. It's what 25-year-old comic book fans read comic books. And, you know, that is a different demographic completely. And I think your casual viewer is going to remember when they were reading when they were 8, not when they were 25, because they're not casual at that point. And so I give Moffat a heck of a lot of credit here for not falling into that, because I think to some degree, you know, modern Doctor Who has kind of, to some degree, fallen into that trap. Both Russell T. Davies and Stephen Moffat have, you know, updated it from what it was when you were 8 years old and brought in things to appeal to a different audience and to the shippers and the and whatnot. And
But when I was 8 years old, it was Trial of a Time Lord. It needed updating. And I'm not going to criticize him for that. And in fact, you know, I like the fact that they can go anywhere with Doctor Who and they can do all sorts of things. They can take it to, and they did over the years, in the classic years, you know, they took it to the Hinchcliffe extreme where Mary Whitehouse was bashing out a missive on her typewriter before the scream of the credits had kind of faded away. And they had the kind of alternate, the kind of, I don't want to put it in too derogatory terms, but the youthful thing, the kind of not play, sort of listen with mother, educative, and all that kind of stuff, and everything else in between,
and innocent, and I think that's it. It's innocent. The old Doctor Who is even to a point. Sure, this old man running around with a young girl in there was never. Never any hint that was anything other than...
Oh, rubbish.
No.
So when Tom Baker was running around with a girl in bear skins or whatever it was that Leela's skimpy costume was made out of, that was completely done without any thought for the adult audience.
No, that's not quite what I'm saying. There's absolutely no question in my mind that the Doctor was not romantically interested in Leela.
That's certainly true.
Okay, I mean, that's it. There is this sort of paternal relationship, and then...
Romana, on the other hand...
Romana is the one exception, and even there, Romana is quite young compared to the Doctor, and yet they do make something out of it. But, you know, as it moved on, particularly with Romana, too, you could see with time that would have probably... And, of course, I think there was a little bit of Tom and Lala wearing off on the performances out there, but... And then later on, there was some Tom and Lala wearing off on their performances too, both ways.
But there's romance in Superman, and that's terribly innocent. The kind of
it is
Clark Kent adoration for. So it, you know, it's not the romance per se. It's more in the approach, I think.
Yeah. Anyway, but what I appreciate here is that Moffat did not. He clearly was doing exactly what they did with the 70s Superman film. He was penning I'm never going to get a chance to write a superhero movie. So, and I always loved them. So I want to do this. So, I mean, I applaud him for not modernizing it like current films are. How about that? That's about the best I can say.
Yeah. I mean, I completely understand what you're getting at, which is you're sort of throwing a lot of. No, I mean, I don't want to denigrate it. I think maybe the modern films can do interesting things, but they are taking other angles on it, and there is something very kind of. I don't think innocent is an inappropriate word to talk about. You know, the original Superman film. It is. It's just a kind of, it's quite a simple story for a man who can fly and has X-ray vision, that is beautifully, beautifully told. And that's the challenge here when you're particularly taking on something that is well known and well loved like that, to be able to write something that both pays homage, does something new, and does it without kind of stomping all over what came before. And for my money, what sells Superman, I mean, maybe I just have the 8-year-old sensibilities, but I think the reason it has the broad appeal it does is that it is incredibly well done, and a lot of that is down to, you know, Christopher Reeve in particular, I think, mm-hmm. you know, getting that performance, because it's a tricky balancing act, and it is just he just does it so well. And mm-hmm. This guy whose name I don't forget, but the
he did a great
ghost Justin Chatwin, who I hadn't seen in anything else, but yeah, he got a real balance between the sort of the Grant and the ghost, and yeah, it was a heightened performance, but I thought it was it was a brave thing to do, to follow in Reeve's footsteps so closely, and he really did pull it off.
There is one scene where when he is on the roof, and as Grant, he bursts through the door and says, "You are not laying a hand on that baby." I swear I was looking at Michael J. Fox in that moment.
Yeah, I can see it now you mention it. I didn't think of it, but
line,
yeah.
The line, the way he delivered it, the whole, you know, push.
The floppy hair.
Like, yeah, it was like, whoa. I don't think that was intentional, because I don't think he was playing Christopher Reeve kind of throughout the rest of it, but yeah, at that one moment, I was like,
yeah, he's,
which, you know, is also a good, it fit with a position anyway. So, you know, just, he does have that sort of genuine and nerdish, appeal. He did an exceptional job. Since we're talking about the acting, let's talk about Capaldi. One of the things that I thought was notable in this episode was, obviously gone is 8 seasons cranky doctor completely. He's nice old guy now, and particularly when he's dealing with children. I find it hard, you know, those scenes where he was talking to the little boy, and then when he was a teenager at school, you know, it seemed so, I say natural isn't quite right the word, but I mean, you could picture, I don't know, you could picture maybe Tom Baker or something with a kid that way. I mean, it seemed to be that he was really on.
What it reminded me of is when you see footage of Capaldi, you know, in real life footage of him meeting fans.
Yes.
When he's talking to the young kids then. And he's not. When he took on the role, and you were watching him on telly and thinking of the guy saying, you know, "Do you want to say a few words?" when the folks soup, ashes were and yet you see him chatting to the kids, and he's you know, it's a bit like he's Malcolm Tucker still as the doctor, but when he's talking to the kids, there's that real kind of Tom Baker getting on their level, really. Yes. Getting on their wavelength and understanding how much the show matters to them and feeling the weight of that, and so it's a lovely thing to watching those videos of people meeting him, and that's what came through to me, seeing him talking to the young Grant in particularly the kind of opening scenes of this episode.
It's funny you should mention it. I mean, I'll completely agree. When I was talking about him with Tom Baker and kids, I was thinking of Tom Baker with kids who are fans. When you'd see some pictures of him out with doing presentations, he would just, he just was perfect. I mean, I know he wasn't, you know, necessarily the nicest guy or anything like that in the world, but he certainly, when he was out there meeting the fans and meeting the kids, he really made the extra effort for them. And you're right, Capaldi does exactly the same. I have seen him go to hospitals for kids who are ill and other situations where he meets them, and he clearly just knows what it means. And that's what I got out of this performance. And you kind of even get it when he's dealing with Grant as an adult, because I think he's showing that this is a kid he's been with for a long time. So,
yeah. And in fact, because there is still that line up on the roof where he says, you can't just go around swallowing things all your life. How old are you? 34?
Yeah.
That you know, you get that sense of him still not quite being able to tell how old people are. So when we actually do get Grant aged 34 or whatever he is, for the most part of the episode, Capaldi's not changing the way he's relating to him. He's still treating him in the same way, you know, treating him. I mean, in a way, it's a wonderful thing that he's not talking down to Grant as a kid, at least not any more than he's talking down to Grant because he's human,
right?
You know, later on, but he's treating him in the same way. Yeah.
So yeah, no, it's kind of where we were seeing the performance going in season 9, but I'm curious to see whether it continues through into series 10. I do like a little bit of the bristly doctor, but you know, you can go too far on that. And I think every time they've tried that so far, Colin Baker, first season of Capaldi, I think for some reason they just take it a little too far at times. So,
yeah, I mean, I don't know. If they're doing it, and they always said this was the thing with Colin Baker, if they're doing it as part of a trajectory, as part of character development, then they've done that. And okay, that was interesting, but it's good that they haven't hung around. It's good that they moved things on quickly and brought us to where we are now. And you could certainly say that they maybe should have done it quicker. In much the same way that you think that sick Dr. Perry relationship should have moved into the Trial of the Time Lord relationship, you know, before the penultimate story, rather than waiting for a whole season.
Right. So, let's see. What have we got? We have got the return of the cut open head aliens. And I don't remember exactly what they were called in the Husbands of River Song. Was Harmony Shoal the name then, too? Or do you remember?
I believe it was something to do with it, but to be honest, I really can't remember much about the Husbands of River Song, and I couldn't be bothered to watch it again. And I kind of knew I should, because I knew this would have Matt Lucas in it, and so I needed to go back and rediscover what had happened to Nardole, because in my mind he'd been killed off.
Yep, he had been killed off.
Which, obviously, it did actually get explained in the episode, so fair play. I just couldn't bring myself to go back and watch it. So I did feel that this episode pretty much stood on its own, even though it had those two or three things linking it back to, well, what was actually the previous episode, although it doesn't feel like it, given that this is the longest time we've been without Doctor Who.
Well, he's been away
since 2004.
I mean, I think that was in passing nod. It's like, I've been away. That's also part of it. But I got to tell you, my daughter, Michelle, positively, absolutely squeed. That's the only word for it. The noise that the kids make when they're like, when the term 24 years was mentioned, she absolutely just kind of curled up in a sort of happy bundle and noise.
How?
Exactly. It was distracting. And it took me a few seconds to figure out why that was when she did that. I'm like, 24 years, 24 years, 24 years, 24. Night on Deryllium. Right. Got it. It's like, oh, geez. So the doctor spent 24 years with River Song before she died. No wonder she's squeeing. So,
but I had no objection to that stuff. I thought it was fairly unobtrusive, and the mood worked. The mood of the doctor, and the fact that he was a little bit distracted and, you know, a little bit sad, all of that worked fine. It was part of the rest of the story, and that was all okay. But the chronology of it, and I'm not talking about just, you know, the kind of talking to the audience, oh, I've been away for a bit, but the 24 years thing didn't fit because, well, and it didn't obviously fit. I mean, why would it be 24 years
on Earth, right?
Because he's a time traveler. Yep. And so I'm thinking, well, if the 24 years matter, because I'm not automatically thinking of Knights Under Ilium, though I did get there in the end, then it would have to matter because he had been living 24 years of linear time, presumably, on Earth, along with Grant, which there was no obvious reason for him to be doing. And so there wasn't. So it's actually pure coincidence. If what we're supposed to take from this is that the scene on the rooftop at the beginning takes place immediately before the Husbands of River Song, and the rest of it takes place after the Husbands of River Song, and in between 24 years has passed for the Doctor, and by coincidence 24 years happens to have passed on Earth.
Yeah, it does.
But even that doesn't work, because he then turns up in Grant's high school, and which end of things is that?
Yep. No.
And he's clearly been travelling around with Nardole for a while as well. So,
One thing I do like, though, I had no problem with Nardole in the episode. He was relatively inobtrusive. But I like the fact that the Doctor has intentionally sought out company.
Yes.
Instead of the, I'm going to grump around and never have a companion again, nonsense that we went through after Rose and Martha and Donna and you know, over and over again. So, I think...
So, I'm... Yeah. I've got to admit that the one thing that I really wasn't looking forward to in this episode was the fact that I knew that Matt Lucas was coming back, and I had not enjoyed the character of Nardole, who was the kind of... squeaky and irritating comic relief that you seem to be obliged to insert in some of these Christmas special episodes for some reason. I've no idea why. And he'd been written out, and, you know, as far as I was concerned, that was that. And so when you get that, you know, opening scene where the hand is raised and he's asking where the little boy's room is, I'm thinking, oh, God, we're going to have all of this kind of forced comedy, and I'm not objecting to the jokes, because I thought that all of the stuff with 8-year-old Grant and the Doctor was an absolute riot, but actually once we got going, the way Nardole was written was absolutely terrific. It was a very understated and performed as understated, the kind of, I guess the best way to describe it, although it's not quite right, is the idiot savant, or the...
Yeah, kind of.
He has hidden depths, at least. Let me put it that way. He's obviously quite an idiot in some ways, but not in other ways, and it's never quite clear which way it's going to be. And that's quite sort of nice and interesting, and Matt Lucas plays that just... spot on, and Capaldi plays to it. I really enjoyed the dynamic. This was the unexpected thing of them together, because somehow he was a less, even despite the kind of bumbling aspects of it, he was a much less needy companion.
Uh-huh.
And he obviously trusts the Doctor. He can obviously do certain things like piloting the TARDIS and so forth, and managed to go off on his own to wherever it was he went when he was piloting the TARDIS, and have adventures and come back in one piece and so forth. And yet when they're together, there's a comfortable companion, which is how you know that they've been traveling together for a while. There's this kind of comfortable companionship, and now I'm thinking, well, I'm not ready for Bill to turn up, because actually I quite want there to be a bit more of Capaldi and Nardole, and this could be the kind of David Tennant, Catherine Tate line up for the Moffat era. And couldn't we just have that for a bit instead, please?
It was good. It was far better than I expected. I'm not gonna disagree there. It was, there wasn't a lot of it though. Nardole wasn't. I mean, the Doctor wasn't in a lot of the episode. So, he was sharing time with the Ghost, and then Nardole was sharing time down the list. So I think that helped. I'm kind of curious about the question about the boys' room, though. Did that mean that building was supposed to be Grant's apartment?
No, it was in the Harmony Shoal building.
Right, but he's asking where the little boys' room is, and he doesn't mean the bathroom. He's saying, no, I'm looking for the little boys' room.
He does mean what the bathroom. The little boys' room. It's
oh yes, I suppose this is quite good. What he's after.
We're having the same cross cultural miscommunication that Moffat is sending off in the episode, because what's his name, the CEO fellow,
Brock,
is saying restroom, which is your silly American euphemism for it. And so Nardole is saying, but I don't want to have a rest. But when he says little boys' room, you're going, well, what does that mean? You're not interpreting the euphemism either, because it's a silly British euphemism.
Well, I mean, a little boys' room is, people do use it here, not very often. I mean, that's how I knew he was saying what could be interpreted as bathroom or restroom. But, because it follows right on the heels of being in a little boy's room. All right. I'll take your comment that is strictly meant to be a comedic element and not the Doctor looking for Grant. All right. Gotcha. All right. And I've watched it twice and I didn't get it even on the second go. But I was paying more attention this time, thinking, yeah, that whole thing about the boys' room, is that imply that we're supposed to be, he's trying to find the little boy. But no. Okay. Why didn't he just use the one in the TARDIS? Never mind. They probably don't have one. But we know we do, because we see it in the preview. So the lesser part of this story is the actual plot with the alien invasion. It's a little bit disjointed and illogical to me.
Really?
Yeah. I mean, I'm not saying it's hard to follow. Not like that. But so, all right, let's try a couple things here. We had the aliens in The Husbands of Riversong that put aside their head and had a gun hidden in there. Now, I can accept that. It's kind of weird, but all right, I can accept that in the Doctor Who universe. That makes, let's not call it sense, but, you're not using your head for your brain. The brain is somewhere else, and you can keep a gun up there, because that makes perfect sense. In this, Dr. Sin is taken over, and it looks like Brock is the bad guy, but we don't know right off the bat that. And then Sin lures Brock, or he wants Brock to come in where the brains are, right? A trap, so that he will get his brain taken over. But then Brock is like, not now, let's do that at midnight, which makes it sound like Brock is setting up Dr. Sin. And then you get into the room, and Dr. Sin starts going on, well, look at the brains. Did you notice that there's some missing? Well, are there some extras? What? No? Well, I don't even know what this project's about. And I checked, there's no deliveries or anything like that. And he's setting this whole thing up as if he's just discovered this thing, and then now Brock is going to kill him. And then suddenly it turns out that Sin is the alien, and that Brock doesn't know anything about it. Why did they go to the elaborate ruse to get him into that room and give him this story if they were just going to knock him over and have surgeons cut his brain out?
I can't understand why they would go to the ruse to get him into the room. What I didn't understand, as you didn't, was the counting of the brains. Because my interpretation of it anyway was, because he says, where is Dr. Sin? And he points.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a brain in a jar.
Just one, that might point out.
Which looks different, indeed. So if there's a what's happening is the brains are being swapped for the brain-like aliens,
mm-hmm.
Where is this disparity in numbers coming from? Because it's one in, one out, isn't it?
And why would Dr. Sin care? Why would he be telling Brock about it?
Why would he care?
And then where is the brain when they open their head up to take the gun out? That's the other part. It's like, wait. You know, and but we're shown that it is supposed to be the brain in there because they do the eye thing. So we're supposed to see the brains behind the head with the eye. And it's like, well, doggone it, guys.
I think they could have left the gun. They could have left the gun thing out. Because anyway, it seems a bit of an awkward place to keep your gun.
It does.
Unless,
not
you
good
know,
for the quick draw.
You have to go through security or whatever. But if you're actually in the Harmony Shell building, which you're the CEO of or whatever, then
even
you hire people.
Remember, Brock said that even this is classified, so even I don't know what's going on in here. It's like, so he's not the top dog.
Well, indeed, he may actually not be at the very top of the hierarchy, but he's probably high enough up to be allowed to carry a weapon.
Oh no, I mean before he gets converted. Afterwards,
he's. Well, afterwards, I guess he's someone else, but he still might not be the top dog. But the people on security are taking orders from him, or the one who looks like him.
Right.
You know, whichever brain is actually in his head at the time, the body that he's wearing probably ought to be allowed to carry a gun. Probably would be allowed to carry a gun. I'm not trying to make a value judgment on it. I think probably. Fewer people ought to be allowed to carry guns in America, but that's let's not go there.
New York City actually might have some gun control laws in place, but yeah.
But would they cover private property?
Well, they're supposed to. But I think they're supposed to. Private property is actually still kind of public. So in other words, a CEO walking through the building with the public and goes, kind of. But you know, the security guards, they could be licensed to do it, but I.
But there's a practical question as well, which is that who's going to know?
Right. It was kind of pointless in tying that back to the Husbands of River Song. I think they could have.
Yeah.
They could have. You know, these aliens, now that we know that they're a brain taking over a body, this reminds me of a Mark Gatiss Doctor Who novel, Third Doctor. During the Dark Years, like the Return of the
Gadarene,
or something like that, Grenadine, or something of that nature, where they're alien brain creatures taking over a town. I thought of that the first time I saw this. It's not an unusual trope, but that just leapt to my mind. And considering that Moffat and Gatiss are pretty good friends, I wonder if there's a little of that in it. But it just, it didn't quite work for me.
Well, I'm gonna
didn't hurt it too badly. The story.
I agree that the story wasn't the main thing. I'm gonna also agree that the counting of the brains was a bit daft. Although having some kind of dialogue between them before the surgeons were released so that we could see the doctor saying I'm an intruder too and he's got sushi because he's a pro.
Right.
That worked for me. I enjoyed that a lot. And overall, the idea of the plot, which is, you know, a straight kind of take over the world by swapping key people, you know, take it straight from spearhead from space even.
Well, true. That too.
Yeah. So, which is fine. And the twist of saying we're going to have a demonstration or an example where we are clearly the safest places to be on the planet in the event of a disaster and people will come to us rather than having to get through the security that's already in place, which would obviously be possible, but a much slower process. I thought that was all quite good. As the doctor said, it's a really good plan.
It's a good plan, yeah. Well, I'm going to put one more pick on the aliens before we go. So you have a team of surgeons. They come in, cut your head open in a bizarre way, diagonally, take your brain out, put the alien in, close it back up. Okay. As a species of alien, that doesn't strike me as the best system that they have to have a team of surgeons to get in there and perform the surgery for you to take over somebody's brain. There's a sort of chicken and the egg thing going there? How, when they first arrived on Earth, did they bring three surgeons with them? And then, at the end, we see the unit soldier who's been taken over. And we know that the surgeons have been off, already killed or damaged at the rooftop, and were not there. So how did the creature get out of Sin and into the unit guy with the surgery scars across the head? Which I'm worried that we're going to see them again.
Oh, we're definitely going to see them again. But it's a good question. I don't quite see how that could have happened, though it didn't occur to me at the time.
So let's see. There were a number of things that I thought were amusing throughout the course. Of course, the bit where the Doctor susses out that Superman and Clark Kent are one and the same.
The whole comics thing. I mean, both drawing the glasses on Superman and looking kind of put out when Grant says everyone knows that.
Not Lois Lane. Yeah, I liked the
and
go ahead.
Spider-Man. That he's saying, what would superpowers be? Well, radiation sickness,
vomiting, hair loss, and death. Yes,
yeah.
That was good.
Yeah.
Simpler time. The setup beautifully, and yet there was just one little minor thing that spoiled it for me. And this is, as mentioned, we're having cold and flu season here in Arizona, and my whole family were sick the last few days. So I happen to know the scene where the Doctor is on the roof with Grant at the beginning, and he pulls the glass of water out.
Yeah.
And hands it to him, which is, you know, typically doctorish, and then he hands him the crystal, and you can see it a mile away. I'm a doctor, have some water, take this.
Yeah,
of course you see it a mile away. There's just one little problem: a pill half that size I have trouble getting down a 10-year-old's throat. Right, I couldn't swallow that crystal. I don't think
it was quite big.
That was huge and spiky. It's like, if that had been perhaps round and a bit smaller, I would have been a little easier to follow on that one. But it's like, wow.
Maybe it was squishy, though.
That kid's a champ.
It worked for me because I was enjoying the fact that that Capaldi had a glass of water in his pocket after having been hanging upside down outside 60th floor window.
Yes, indeed.
And so it worked as just a kind of quirky gag. But then, of course, once you begin to stack it all up together, and you can see where it's all leading, and he gives his little speech about how amazing these crystals are and how there are only four left in the universe and so on and so forth, you know what's happened. But that was what I enjoyed so much about the opening sequence, because there was all that kind of great comedy shtick that I thought Capaldi was just doing really, really well. But none of it was just gratuitous. It was actually all leading up so that in the 9 minutes or so before the credits rolled, he'd actually managed to set up the entire ghost backstory and his nanny double life and everything. Mm-hmm. So it was economical and brilliant.
So the ghost, not the ghost, but the crystal itself, the ghost of love and wishes, the name of the thing. It senses what you want, and it draws power from a star, and it grants the wish. The Doctor is in New York trying to fix the time problems that he's created in New York. Is his wish
to get
Amy and Rory back? Is that what he's trying to do there?
It could be. I will say that was actually my one criticism of that whole sequence, was very much like the Riversong chronology in this. I was thinking, well, why is he trying to fix the time anomalies now? Why now in his timeline? Because it's quite a long time since, a long time has elapsed for the Doctor since he left Amy and Rory in New York. And he left them in New York quite a long time ago, because Are we assuming it's present day, the most of it? So
yeah,
we're 90, I guess 92 in that opening sequence.
Yeah, that'd be a good guess.
It looks like there's a mobile phone mast, isn't there? So anyway, whatever it is, it's some 60 plus years later. So isn't there a problem with all the in between the time anomalies and stuff?
Yes, I think
it was stuff I really didn't need to be thinking about when I should have been paying attention to the story.
But why is he doing it at this point in his time? Because River Song just died.
Except if he's had 24 years,
yep,
that should have happened before the husband's of River Song.
Yes.
So, I mean, maybe it didn't, but you don't see Nardole in that sequence. So you certainly get the impression that at that point he is traveling alone.
Yeah. So I could see how that would bring, I mean, notwithstanding the obvious time flaws here, I could see how River Song, then, you know, maybe it's time to rescue her parents, but because I'm lonely. But yeah, it doesn't fit in the timeline. Once again, Moffat's timey-wimey has not worked right. He didn't think it out enough. But all right, let's see. What else have we got here? Did mention that the two people that Brock was referring to as Miss Schuster and Miss Siegel will answer any questions you have, or something like that, or we'll see you out. Those are the names of the creators of Superman.
Oh, very nice.
You hear that? You hear that a lot. I think I forgot which. I think when they did the Superboy TV series, he went to like Schuster University. It's you hear those names a lot with regards to Superman. So that was Moffat kicking one in for the fans.
I've got one question.
Mm-hmm.
On your ambulances, that thing with the snake, is that on all your ambulances?
Oh,
because the ambulance that the guys turned up in, the alien chappies turned up in, had this symbol with a snake on a shield or something like that.
Caduceus, maybe? It's like a winged cross with a snake up and down on it. I don't know that it's on all ambulances, but it's a medical symbol.
Ah, okay. So it would be you'd have the same symbol on your ambulances in New York and say San Francisco.
You could, yeah. Yeah.
I mean, because that to me, because obviously I don't see US ambulances on a regular basis.
I definitely
saw one in 1996 in San Francisco. Vancouver, in fact, but apparently San Francisco. And actually, thinking about it, apparently New Year's 1999. But anyway,
yeah,
I didn't know whether on that ambulance. Well, I guess it probably wouldn't have anything to do with
it's not a symbol that
the master
be surprised by. Let's put it that way.
No,
okay,
fair enough.
I won't swear that it's on every ambulance or every, but it's definitely. I'm pretty sure. Caduceus, I think, is the name of it. I don't know how to spell that, but it's something to do with medical. It's a medical symbol. Kind of like the barber pole somehow once had something to do with it. But I thoroughly enjoyed the joke about evacuating the Tokyo building by flooding the downstairs with Pokemon.
Yeah. Yep.
My son.
That would work as well.
We had just spent a fair amount of hours yesterday hunting Pokemon in the park. So, the day before, I guess we watched it. So, let's see. Doctor Standard, no plan, no. What did he say? No hope, no plan, no problem. The typical. I'm a little not liking of that. That has been a sort of a mainstay of a lot of the Moffat episodes, where it's clear that the Doctor is not actually working to a plan until the very end. And that's kind of a poor way to explain a Deus Ex Machina ending to a story, because you're not setting anything up. Kind of is.
Well, the whole thing, the point was the ghost's superpowers, which had already been firmly established. The choices between the kind of I guess the much more Tom Baker end of things, where the reason the Doctor is so brilliant is because he is a very, very, very quick thinker. He's intelligent and he's a lateral thinker. He can see things in different ways, and he has all this experience, and so he can see solutions and arrive at them in an instant where other people can't see them. And the other end of it is the Sylvester McCoy era. So maybe you'll say it should be more like the Sylvester McCoy era, where you have the arch manipulator Doctor, who has a plan all along and is moving the pawns on the chessboard, and you never quite know what the plan is, because obviously that would destroy the suspense. But at the end of it, it's all revealed that yes, he had a plan, and these were where all the pieces went. This is not that end.
I prefer to go Troughton, where you don't feel like he has a plan, but in fact, actually, he's either very smart and very quick, or he did have a plan, but you just didn't quite get it. Unlike the Sylvester McCoy, which is you feel like they're laboriously telling you that there's a chessboard being played, and they still don't show you the pieces. So, yeah, but because they keep, and I don't just mean this episode. I mean, this has been a sort of a, it's kind of like Moffat keeps coming back to these certain themes, like I'm going to talk to the alien and I'm going to tell them to look me up in a dictionary and they're going to run away, or, you know, stand off at Stonehenge and shout at them a little bit and tell them, yeah, which one are you going to try taking me? Here's kind of another example of that one. In this one, I'm giving you a chance at mercy, and of course the aliens don't take it, which is the important part. So then he has to defeat them, but there have been a few episodes, and I can't name them, where it's specifically called out right at the end that the Doctor is literally, I haven't got a clue, but I'm gonna come up with one. And I would prefer that not to quite be as explicitly stated, because I'm taking it a little bit literally, as if, yeah, you're right,
the Doctor
is actually clueless here at this point. Oh, okay. Yeah,
he's not clueless, and he's not getting lucky. I think getting lucky is problematic. Occasionally, allowing someone else to have agency is quite important, and so that's one thing that's okay. I agree with you. I don't like the Doctor threatening and intimidating, which is, you know, the kind of thing that happens in the Pandorica Opens and a number of other Moffat stories, and he has done that quite a lot. But that's not the same as saying you're going to give them the option of mercy, which is a very, very RTD era approach, because the Poison Sky and whatever it was called, the burning
Suntaran stream,
whatever it is. Suntaran stratagem, that's it. He goes onto the Suntaran ship specifically to give them a chance, rather than just straight blowing them out of the sky. That's the complete opposite end. It's a diametrically opposite approach. Rather than using threats and force, or threats of force, in order to intimidate your opponents, what you're doing is saying, you will only use force, you'll only even attempt to use force as a very, very last resort once every other avenue has been exhausted, which I think is a really important aspect of the Doctor, and I cringe when that part of it gets lost. So I'm agreeing on that, but the thing that in this works okay is the Doctor doesn't necessarily have a plan, no one else has a plan, the Doctor does something, rather than doing nothing, rather than becoming paralyzed, and while he's doing something, he manages to think up a plan. So he does come up with a plan in the end, and he does so by being very brilliant, very fast, and working out, you know, what resources he's got available to him, and then using them, and all the while confounding the enemy. So from that point of view, this one works, but I don't see it as getting lucky. It's the Doctor being clever.
Well, I perhaps
he's being clever and quick. He's turning it around in an instant, rather than laying it all out in advance.
But it was just luck that it happened.
As Robbie Byrne says,
the
best laid plans of mice and men gang off to glay.
All right, going back to the threatening doctor, let me ask you a question. In the Pandorica opens, the 11th Doctor stands there on the stones, and he basically gets the mic, and he shouts at them, and he says, "Just remember who's standing in your way. Which one of you wants to try it first?" And they all kind of back off. Now, I can
Which doesn't make any sense at all.
I can kind of take that, and well, considering what they're trying to do, yeah. But yeah. I can kind of see that
And
as
some
a
of them are Daleks.
I can kind of see that yeah. as a threat. Now, going back to Silence in the Library, when Back is up against the wall, the creatures are coming at him, and he stands there and he says, "You're in the biggest library in the universe, look me up." Is that really a threat, or is that... To me, that one comes off as less of a threat. That's more of a, like, let's have an informed decision here. I'm not saying I'm going to destroy you. I'm just saying maybe you should look at this and decide, because he could also be saying, look at what I do for good.
Yes.
And I sympathize with your cause, and I can help make it better, or I can... You know, but if you're going to be up against me, you might want to check that out too. So I didn't.
It's a different thing. Don't mistake me. Don't underestimate me. That's okay. But what you get, and the Pandorica opens is a great example of it, is pure hyperbole, because he has nothing. He has absolutely nothing in that. He's just trading on the fact that in the past he has. Yeah, he has defeated them, and he's not defeated them in a particularly gratuitous way or anything. But his suggestion is that, you know, if anyone attempts to, they will perish. So it is hyperbole, and it's both weak because it's a last resort, and it's violent.
Mm. And in this one, we're back to, he actually walks into their lair to offer them mercy. Mm. So we are doing exactly what he did in Suntaran's stratagem, in a way.
Yeah, I like. That's who the Doctor is. Never cruel, never cowardly.
But sadly, they didn't take him up on it. And so they got defeated, sort of.
But they'll be back.
Yes, they'll be back. All right, well... I don't know that I have anything else. I was actually slightly disappointed when, at the end, the spaceship's being flown off and the Doctor's on the roof and Brock is there on the roof and the Doctor's got his back to him and Brock reaches over and pulls out the gun out of his head because now he's still a threat. And the Doctor whips around Sonic, boom, done. Gun blows up. You know, we have that whole magic wand thing with the Sonic screwdriver, which I kind of don't like, but really, if he could do that with that gun, how many thousands of guns has he had pointed at him that he could have just fried with the Sonic over the years? I would have preferred they found a better way to do that.
I would agree in the sense that I think we're both over the magic wand. We're long since over the magic wand. I did like that moment because it's another kind of way in which I thought the whole tone and pacing of this episode was well judged, because often in the action films you do get, you know, you've seen off the threat, but then you've got to have the showdown with the bad henchman, and then you've got to have the showdown with the bad baddie, and it goes on and on and on. And yeah. And Brock whips out the gun and says, "It's not over," and you're thinking, "Oh right, here we go." And the Doctor just turns around and says, "It so is."
Yeah.
Just dismisses it, just like that. Brilliant.
Well, I haven't got anything else. I can say I it was one of the few Christmas special I enjoyed. I wouldn't put it up with the greatest of episodes, but I enjoyed it thoroughly.
The Christmas Carol.
No.
Christmas Invasion. Yeah, there are some greats.
Well, Christmas Carol.
Yeah. In fact, I think I might watch that right now. Or shall I watch Superman? I might watch Super. I've still got Superman and a Christmas Carol to watch. So no call for that.
But you'll be able to pick
maybe next year.
All right. Well then, Simon, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure, as always.
and listeners. Thank you for joining us for this special cold and flu and Christmas season episode.
And, Happy New Year to you all.
Yes, Happy New Year. This should go out... when is New Year?
New Year Sunday? Will be the moment this goes out, I believe.
Right, I think that's right. We go out at midnight Arizona time, so on Monday.
And Monday is January the 1st, 2017. So hello, 2017.
Hello, and thanks to all our listeners. And we'll talk to you next time on Fusion Patrol.
Fusion Patrol is a Lone Locust production. Like us? Please consider becoming our sponsor at patreon.com/fusionpatrol. We'd really appreciate it if you could leave us a review on iTunes. Stop by and visit us at our website, fusionpatrol.com. Search for us on Facebook under Fusion Patrol. Check out our Twitter handle, @FusionPatrol. Or just send us an email at feedback@fusionpatrol.com. Please come join the conversation. Our music is Fight the Future by Amber Wolf.